flow and hello to those on the phone, and welcome to the afternoon session of day two. I apologize that we are running a few minutes late, but we will begin with the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. For the benefit of those on the phone, I am Matthew Mela, Governor SUNY's incoming budget director. I am joined by Matt Dellen, Governor SUNY's current budget director, Commissioner Charlie Arlinghouse of the Department of Administrative Services, and Joe Bouchard, who is the Assistant Commissioner at DAS. For the record, would ENCR be able to introduce themselves and begin their presentation?
Of course, thank you. My name is Sarah Stewart. I serve as the Commissioner of the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. And with me is Chris Moreno. Would you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Chris Moreno. I'm the Chief of Administration for the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources.
Great. I'll jump right in. Good afternoon. It's an honor to be here with you today to present the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources budget request for the 2022-2023 biennium. This is just the second time that ENCR has presented a budget. This has only been a department as of July 2017 when Governor SUNY took advantage of an opportunity to leverage connections by merging parks and recreation and forests and lands with the State Library, Historical Resources, and the New Hampshire State Council on the Arts. These five divisions share a mission to protect, preserve, promote, and manage the state's natural and cultural resources, supporting New Hampshire's high quality of life and strengthening the experiences of our residents and guests. The current COVID-19 pandemic has only reinforced the public's engagement with the great outdoors, longing for community connections, and overall appreciation for cultural experiences. One illustration of this boom of support is our online donation button on the State Parks website. During the 2019 calendar year, parks received $20,554 from online donations. So far, in the 2020 calendar year, parks have received over $82,000 in online donations. We're a big department. In your packet, you can review a snapshot of how large we are. We care for approximately 884 buildings of various types, with a total value reaching $65 million. We also care for 22 bridges, 26 dams, 147 septic systems, 91 water systems, over 300 miles of roads and parking lots, and close to 1,000 pieces of art. We're heading into another busy winter season where we oversee the management of 7,200 miles of snowmobile trails, a very important part of the state's booming outdoor recreation economy. This department is responsible for managing 514,739 acres with reservation and easement stewardship. We're responsible for the care of the forest landscape that defines our state and is so important to our economy. We provide the public with a wide variety of outdoor recreational activities or opportunities on state-owned lands and trails. We support the New Hampshire forest-based economy through timber sales and the state forest nursery seedling sales. We conduct management to promote wildlife habitat and protect important plant species and communities, conduct education and research programs, and ensure that state-held conservation easement properties are well-managed and contributing to the state's economic and environmental health. The significant scope of the ENCR is also demonstrated by the ways in which it touches many aspects of the daily lives of our citizens in every community throughout the state. Since the start of the pandemic, the Arts Council has stepped up its interaction with constituents, meeting regularly via Zoom with grantees, art organizations, and artists to understand the impact of the pandemic and provide support and guidance. A community conversation series of five online discussions open to the public featured representatives of nonprofit and for-profit art businesses sharing their experiences and hopes for the future, and an artist-specific series within the work. Council staff have also been directly involved in convening art sector representatives to assist in writing guidance for reopening the sector with the state's economic reopening task force. As we look to the future, by planning our fiscal year 2022 and 23 budget, we are very sensitive to the greater impact this pandemic has on the overall budget of the state. We must fulfill our statutory obligations while delivering excellent customer service, consistently a top priority here. Our staff interact with municipalities, nonprofits, volunteer fire departments, town recreation departments, volunteer groups, and individual citizens daily as we work to assist them achieve their mission. To that end, we recognize the need to invest wisely within our agency in order to successfully achieve these goals while honoring the fact that we are spending hard-earned taxpayer dollars and achieving the necessary cuts to support the overall New Hampshire balanced budget. Our budget request of $57.1 million reflects the responsibilities we have and the opportunities we seek every day to serve the citizens of this state. Comprised mainly of federal and other agency income funds, we are seeking a general fund budget of $7.6 million in fiscal year 22 and $7.9 million in fiscal year 2023. The increase between years is mainly attributed to salary and benefit costs for the 27th pay period in fiscal year 2023. Overall, our general fund budget comprises only 1/8 or 13% of our overall budget. This general fund request of $7.6 million reflects a cut of $1.263 million or 15% from the fiscal year 21 efficiency budget and includes $416,000 of prioritized needs for 2022 and 2023, as well as a combination of alternative funding from within the department, from other fund sources, as well as sources outside the department for a portion needed to maintain some operations, which I will address shortly. The NCR maintains a federally funded portion of the overall budget request for fiscal year 2022 and 23 of $9.8 and $9.9 million, respectively, representing about 1/6 of the department's total funding. The state benefits significantly from these federally funded programs, many of which require a state match. If the state does not provide this match, the federal funds targeted for New Hampshire are reallocated to other states. The remaining $39.6 million of our budget request consists of other funds as agency income and is generated primarily through our operationally self-funded state park system. The budget request for the Division of Parks and Recreation reflects an increase of $1.4 million or a 4% increase over a 2021 adjusted authorized budget. The major areas of increase are personnel costs, elimination of general funds, support of historic sites, increases in federal funds, and payments made to the general fund for cost recovery. This request is supported by revenue generated by parks operations, OHRV registrations, and federal grants. Through fiscal year 2019, our campgrounds, beaches, day use parks, and concessions revenue have seen an increase of over $5 million, 7.3% a year, since 2011, when the park fund was carrying a negative balance of $800,000. This request for the Division of Parks and Recreation supports unprecedented demand for our state park and trail system. Demand has been out of control during the pandemic through our reservation system. While the pandemic had a significant impact at the end of fiscal year 2020 due to the closures of campgrounds and seaside beaches, revenue in fiscal year 2021 is only 2% less than fiscal year 2019 revenue. This is with limited capacity. This is offset by the $500,000 in additional expenses to respond to the pandemic. However, we anticipate continued revenue growth going forward as we operate under additional conditions to keep visitors and staff safe and request support for a budget that allows us to do that. Attached is an overview of the division to provide additional background that frames our work, focus, and accomplishments. The revenue from our state forests and parks not only supports their stewardship, but is also a significant economic driver, providing jobs, supporting the forest product industry, and making New Hampshire a great place to work and play. Remaining sources are comprised of committed trust funds and other legislatively mandated dedicated funds with a small portion of transfer funds from interagency partnerships. Next, within the $57.1 million budget, we intend to maintain our record of making smart investments at the local level throughout our state. We plan to return approximately $8 million in program revenue ranging from grants and aid to community trails and recreation maintenance to outdoor recreation, municipality grants to art development and historical artifacts and site preservation programs. That's $8 million back. With this overall budget in mind, I would like to now make the case for our prioritized needs. As I mentioned earlier, we are looking for $416,000 in general funds for both fiscal year 22 and fiscal year 23 in order to achieve the minimum needed to fulfill our statutory obligations. The New Hampshire arts and cultural sector has been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic, and recovery will not be instantaneous after vaccines are available. Fully funded grants from the Arts Council for operating and programmatic support in fiscal year 22 and 23 will be essential to rebuild this sector of our economy. The State Library will need to maintain its automated information systems database with these prioritized funds, and we will need some assistance for DOIT support throughout the department. Our remaining needs can be addressed with some internal and external fund transfers. For example, the Bureau of Historic Sites will now be 100% funded by the Parks Division, and we will apply some support from the Bureau of Trails to our forest protection staff as they have seen an increase in OHRB enforcement. These are ways we are problem-solving internally to temporarily maintain the levels of safety citizens expect when on the trails or visiting the special places that we manage. The Division of Historic Resources presents a more nuanced challenge. In order to maintain the work that they are obligated to perform, we need to look outside of the department for assistance. One concept is to allow some temporary funding from the Conservation Place Fund allocated from LSHIP administrative support in the amount of $385,000. This would require a change to the language in RSA 261:97. Should this not be an option, we would request consideration to revisit our prioritized needs amount. As I conclude this presentation, I would like to thank the governor for his support this year. We have navigated uncharted territory. In the arts and culture sector, the governor's direction of Federal CARES Act funds to nonprofit organizations and to live venues and the inclusion of self-employed artists and creative workers in the state's unemployment program have been a huge help. I would also like to thank the DNCR staff for their flexibility and commitment to excellence during these strange times. The New Hampshire State Library staff have been back working from the State Library building since the end of June, and the library itself has been open to the public by appointment only since July 6th. The statewide interlibrary loan van service, which moves materials between all 234 New Hampshire public libraries, as well as some schools and academic libraries, resumed full service in mid-September. Our library staff is focused on innovative, forward-thinking technology that will make us even stronger as a service provider in the future. Constituent comments showcase the high quality of customer service that the DNCR team delivers, pandemic or not. A patron of the State Library wrote, quote, "I would like to express my extreme gratitude in the work you do. My father's lifetime passion was reading. The loss of his vision was profound, and the digital books were his lifeline. I am convinced that they extended his life by years." Compliments to the Division of Historical Resource staff. Quote, "Again, I thank you for all of your endeavors to get the meeting house to this gorgeous sign. The fact that most of your work was in the time of COVID makes everything that much more impressive. Stay well and thank you." From a Kentucky Lake State Park visitor, quote, "The reception center was welcoming and informative and helpful. Same for the store and the boat rental too. Everyone was friendly and helpful." And from an arts organization who received grant support recently, quote, "I cannot tell you enough times how appreciative we are of this award. Our 2020 season was interrupted. We are working hard to plan for 2021. This award will help us continue through the pandemic and plan for what we hope will be an exciting 2021 season. The work accomplished within the New Hampshire Department of Natural and Cultural Resources clearly plays a vital role in maintaining the quality of life that we are so proud of. The work we can do also aligns strategically with the goals set forth by our governor. We are positioned to bolster our economic future through a robust and responsible outdoor recreation economy and a creative economy that is being recognized as a priority in communities large and small. Thank you for your time today, and we're ready to answer your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yeah. I noticed you have some items on the table in front of you. Would you like to speak to those?
Yes, thank you for noticing. These are some of our newest Christmas ornaments that are on sale at our State Park website. You'll see there's two from Canon, and there's the plume and the Mount Washington. Top of Mount Washington, the Mount Washington ornament branded this year. These products are made by the same company that makes the United States Capitol annual ornament. So we're very proud of the quality, and you can purchase them for your loved ones on nhstatepark.org.
And what would the price be for one of those?
So, thank you for asking. The two for Canon are $29.95, and the other two are $19.99.
Well, I'll take two of all of those. looking at the prioritized needs, this is pages 186, 204, and 222 in the packet. I see in your written remarks an amount of 416,000 general funds, but I don't believe that, or I might be missing something here, but I'm looking at page 222, which has a request of 438,000 100% general funds. Page 204, a request 302,000 100% general funds, and whatever page I am missing has a similar request. Just want to make sure that we're on the
same. Great. This is why I brought this, Marina.
Thanks for the question. I'm happy to clarify that for you. So within the cumulative total of prioritized funds that are identified in our budget, of that total, $460,000 is the general fund. The arts division, we've identified $302,000, which is the $282,000 in the grant fund and the $20,000 contract. Within the library, we've identified a total of $89,000, $40,000 of which is for the automated information systems request, F57 to support database maintenance and membership and so forth. And we also have identified $49,000 cumulatively for general services support. Now, this portion of the prioritized needs was built into our budget, but it's a figure we received from administrative services to put into our budget as part of the transfer that goes to administrative services. And then the other final piece of that $416,000 is in the DOIT budget for our department, commissioner's office, county unit 292. We have $24,000 identified in there, which again is also a figure assigned from DOIT to put into our budget to identify as a prioritizing.
Thank you for that clarification. And on page 204, looking at Council on the Arts grant program, the explanation mentions legislation at the federal level that's been passed by the House, has not yet been approved by the Senate. I guess what I'm pointing out is there's a lot of speculative language in the explanation, right? If approved, will most likely result in increased grants. Do you have, I guess, what level of confidence do you have in these federal funds? And then assuming that they are passed and this was funded in the budget, obviously, you know, the best case their department, if they're funded in the budget, federal action does not materialize, those funds will last, I think.
If you don't mind, I'd like to turn to Director Jimmy Lupi, who is on the phone and she has been tracking all of this. Jimmy, are you there?
I am, but I'm having trouble hearing, so if you could repeat the question, that would be terrific.
Yes, and I apologize for the audio issues. Acoustics in the room have been a recurring challenge this week. But essentially, just looking at the Council on the Arts Grants Program, contingent on federal action, could you walk me through, essentially, if the bill does pass in Congress, essentially what happens in the scenario where a bill passes in Congress, this is funded in the budget, versus this is funded in the budget, and a bill does not pass in Congress?
So funding for the National Endowment for the Arts is included in the federal budget process. And so as that bill makes its way, we will see what happens. At this point, we do know that Congress had approved an increase to the National Endowment. Obviously, with everything that's happening on the federal level right now, that budget process appears to be stalled. That would be for the next fiscal year, the next federal fiscal year. And so, you know, just like with the state budget process, we are waiting that out. And we will see, you know, we will see what happens. This current administration, the president has recommended in the past that the National Endowment for the Arts the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Institute for Museums and Libraries be completely unfunded, but Congress in its wisdom has seen otherwise. Once the federal budget is resolved, then we will go through our regular competitive application process with the National Endowment for the Arts for funding for that particular fiscal year. We are awaiting news right now about our award for the upcoming fiscal year. So they're running, they sort of run a year behind. And so we made an application and we're waiting for notification on that now. I hope that answered your question.
Yes, I appreciate that. Are there any other questions for the NCR? Director Zellhoff.
Thank you, Commissioner. When we heard from fellowship earlier, I spoke with them about the importance of increased partnership with your department as we look to be able to maintain our historic sites and our cultural resources in times of want, as we have less resources, and they're fully committed to partnering with you all and working with the governor and the legislature to ensure that the maximum funding can be made available. So obviously we'll have to figure out the details, but yeah. I fully suspect that Vision Taylor and her team will be happy to work with the department to look at what an appropriate temporary draw from those places to support historic resources would be.
Thank you for having that conversation. I appreciate it. That's good news.
Commissioner Arlen. Sorry. I wanted to say that four years ago when the governor wanted to create what's now DNCR out of the rearrangement of a bunch of things, there's a lot of skepticism about it, honestly, I think. And I remember going over a meeting with the state librarian, the acting director of cultural resources at the time, I believe. A very snowy day with James Burnett. We almost got snowed into our parking place. We had a great meeting and he was very cooperative. Other people were very skeptical. I said to the governor at one point, one of the challenges is going to be on the other piece, the economic development piece, everyone wants to do economic development. And you're not going to have a problem there, but you're going to have a lot of trouble finding somebody who is not going to be either natural or cultural. And who's able to be both. And I just have to say, he did a hell of a job of finding somebody who is able to value appropriately and sincerely the entirety of the department and who probably knows the mission of combining the resource elements better than he does. So it's great. It's very exciting, and you're the only department with Christmas ornaments so far.
Thank you,
Commissioner. Commissioner Stewart, would you just be able to talk a little bit about how New Hampshire funds its parks compared to other states and why New Hampshire is a model for the rest of the country?
Yes, thank you. I'll speak briefly and then I'll let Director Bryce speak a little bit more. But in true New Hampshire fashion, we like to do things a little bit different. And I think that for us in the situation that the parks have been in over the last 10 years or so while Director Bryce has been at the helm, this model has given the state parks a huge opportunity to grow and to get financially sound and be simply responsible. But Director Bryce talks to all of his colleagues around the country, and so I'm sure he could distinguish a little bit better how we operate the whole thing.
Thank you, Philip Bryce, Director of Vision Parks and Recreation. If it's okay, I'll just sit here. Can you hear me with my mask on?
For the benefit of those on the phone, if we could find a mic for Director Bryce or to come forward, appreciate that.
Yes, I was on the phone last night with some state park director colleagues, and increasingly states are looking to revenue generation to support their park systems, because we all know it's so hard for natural resources agencies to compete with all the other needs of government. And so like South Carolina, they're very heavily self-funded. lot of states are like 90% or so. Some states, I think like Missouri, they're not funded through fees. They're funded through like a tax on gas, you know, additional tax on gases, on gas. But New Hampshire has been a model, and I think one of the things we talked about was, interesting enough, given your question, was the entrepreneurial spirit that has to be developed and has to be created. And that doesn't happen unless the legislative authority is there to allow it to happen. And we are very fortunate in New Hampshire that our legislation directs us, that our statutory authorities direct us to behave like a business in the context of our mission. And that goes all the way down to the person in the field. And we discussed that, and some of the states that were on the call talked about, yeah, we have that problem. Or we can't get our staff to do, to really engage in doing retail. You know, we turn, you know, $500,000-$600,000 a year of profit from our retail operations in the park system into the parks fund. And in addition to the enhancement of the experience of having that available, and of course, then the opportunity to buy some great ornaments. So, so you know, that's a real part of it, but that comes from the top, you know, from the legislature and the governor to say, yes, you know, and not have things happen that discourage the staff from having that, that entrepreneurial spirit. So that's a really, really key part of it. Comes back to the legislative authority. I hope the state never messes with that. And then the opportunity to do like transfers between accounts. That is critical to be able to meet immediate needs. And so that's one of the key components too. So it's very detailed, you know, elements of it, but that's what defines, you know, that's what defines what we can do. And we're really lucky in New Hampshire to have that support.
Thank you, Director Bryce. Do we have any questions on the phone?
There are any questions? Please.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you for a brief update on the cemetery that you all had to be involved with earlier with this year.
Yes, thank you. We have Director Ben Wilson here who can probably brief us best on the success and the collaboration between different state agencies to make sure that the job is done safely and effectively.
Thanks for the question. Ben Wilson, Director of the Division of Historical Resources. This was a really interesting project. I had no idea you really could move a cemetery in the modern era. And up in the start, they had a very serious issue with the upper and the Nootsic River wearing away at one of their cemeteries. And between Fish and Game, the state police, and the town, the cemetery trustees in the town, and the selectmen, we were able to come up with a solution for our state archaeologist Mark Dobrowski, and we were able to do what we're supposed to do, and we worked as a group. They were successful in finding another cemetery where they can inter all of the existing graves, and everything went very smoothly. In fact, we've been reached out to by Northumberland with a similar situation, so there might be more coming down the road, but it was a really interesting project and work seamlessly with other agencies. And, very successful.
That's tremendous, and it's been an interesting story to watch unfold, and applaud the department and collaboration across state government for getting it done.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
We do not have an ornament to commemorate that.
Next year.
We could. Any final
questions? I would thank the entire team. Keep up the good work, and everyone go out and buy an ornament.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you follow that?
I know you want to give me one for free, but it was violating state officials.
Exactly.
I would have been unable to accept it.
Well, be
friendly. You know, exactly.
That's
what I was planning to do.
I would now like to call forward the Public Employees Labor Relations Board.
Hello, this is Doug Ingersoll. I'm on the phone, so I'm just going to assume you can hear me.
Yes, I'm the. I appreciate you joining us remotely.
Yep.
Please go ahead and begin your presentation.
Sure. So I'm the director and counsel for the Public Employee Labor Relations Board, or the PELRB. I'm going to say at the outset that this is nowhere near as interesting as the presentation you just heard. And I think my goal is to do my best to get you back on your original schedule. I do want to give a quick overview of the board. We have four full-time employees, myself, another attorney, and two support staff. The board itself consists of members with experience in labor relations on the management and labor side. And the board also has chairs which represent the public at large. The board functions as an administrative tribunal responsible for administering the state's public sector collective bargaining law. This law applies to employers and employees at the state, county, city, and municipal levels. Cases are heard and decided by a panel of three board members as well as by a hearing officer. And after any internal requests for review are complete, final decisions may be appealed to the state Supreme Court. A few statistics before I hit a couple of the numbers in the budget. Currently, there are about 614 bargaining units in the state, corresponding to roughly 570 collective bargaining agreements. In fiscal year 2020, 111 cases were filed with the board, 282 decisions and orders were issued, and 15 bargaining unit elections were held. I submitted a handout ahead of today's hearing, which has a little more detail about some of the actual kinds of cases and operations. And we also have a very comprehensive website, which I encourage you to visit, or anybody who's listening to this, to learn more about what we do. As to the details of our 22-23 budget, I have just a few comments. It's relatively straightforward. I want to thank Max Zellum, who I believe had to spend a minimal amount of time looking at our budget, but I've had a couple of communications with him over the past few months, and it seems to me that he's appreciated what I've had to say, and he's managed our requests appropriately. I understand he's moving on, and best of luck with your future endeavors. So big picture, our general fund budget fiscal year 21 was $484,000. Fiscal year 22, it's $493,000. And in 23, $509,000. Most of the increases are driven by Class 10 personnel and Class 60 benefits. For example, those totaled $420,000 in fiscal year 21. In 22, it's $431,000. In 23, it's $449,000. 96% of our budget is personnel benefits, rents, and leases. Rent, we currently have 2,360 square feet at $15.70 a square foot. Our lease expires at the end of June 2022, and we have put an increase in that line item, and that is class 22 for fiscal year 23, anticipating a possible change in our rent expense. As to staffing, we're not making any changes to staffing levels. Other categories, current expenses, telecom, in-state travel are all reduced. However, those numbers to begin with are fairly nominal, so they don't represent large savings, obviously, to the state as a whole. Transfers to OIT, there is an increase. The main reason for the increase is that in fiscal year 22, we are scheduled to spend $3,500 to replace a switch and router. We're currently using one provided on loan from DOIT to replace one which failed probably during fiscal year 20. We are not planning for any other hardware replacements in 22 and 23. Additional prioritized needs, the only thing you'll see in there is for class 27. Those figures were provided to us by DOIT, and as I understand it, it relates to Microsoft 365 with Teams, some cybersecurity items, and Salesforce licenses. So that's all I have. I'm certainly available to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Director Ingersoll. Are there any questions for the Public Employee Labor Relations Board? Director Zellum.
Thank you, Director. I really appreciate, again, tight fiscal management that your agency, like many small agencies, have. And we know your budget is in and out. And I appreciate our prior conversations around the ability to make the governor's part. And so we did make an adjustment to the target for the board to ensure that they could continue to operate well within the statutes. When you have four employees in your personnel-heavy agency, there's really not a lot of room after the layoff of the four employees, everyone does 2.5 jobs. I do have one quick question. The other funds, and I apologize for not knowing this, what are the other funds in the agency budget? Looks like it's a 6 month fund.
So can you give me a page reference?
Just looking at the accounting unit, the sole accounting unit, it looks like there's some agency income in addition to
So the source for agency income are one type of case includes a filing fee. I think it's $60, and it's been $60 for 25 years. And the other cases don't have any filing fees. And in the past, the subject has come up during the legislative phase of budget review, and the idea of initiating fees for all filings for all kinds of cases and raising the fee schedule to correspond to the trends that have been going on for years in the state and federal court system in New Hampshire was discussed and set aside. So that's not, it doesn't yield a significant, again, I'm assuming I'm answering the thing you were asking about other funds, agency income 009.
No,
it's a small number. I think when I looked at this maybe 3 or 4 years ago, it would be possible to generate $15,000 to $20,000 in additional income, but the legislature was not interested in imposing the kind of fee structure necessary to accomplish that. And I think there was opposition to creating potential barriers to people who otherwise might file cases with the board.
Director, this is Nestor Gallo again. Do you have a rough, you said this $60 filing fee only applies to some cases. Do you have a rough percentage of how many cases have a fee versus have no filing fee?
Yeah, I would say probably 75 to 80%.
Have no fee?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Commissioner Arles?
Hi, Governor Arles. I have two questions. The first is, adjudicative boards in the state are treated very differently. And most of them, I think, are like yours, who receive what you might refer to technically as chump change or sitting. How much do your board members make?
Yeah, they're essentially volunteers. I think their per diem is $50 a day. Plus mileage expenses.
They don't look at some sort of consistency in that amount. Right? There's a board that's worse than that. They get $60 a quarter, which is just crazy. But and they write their own decisions. My broader question is, one of the things we're seeing at the state level is the increase in the number and splintering of unions. So, you know, whereas at one time there was one, you know, contract negotiation, and you had a negotiator, they negotiated with the state employees, and that was it. And then there's three, and then there's six, and then there's eight, and then there's 10, and, And I know that I don't want you to comment on cases that are before you about whether somebody constitutes a bargaining unit or anything, but are you seeing this sort of splintering? It's happening a lot at the state level, which, you know, obviously operation is a challenge. Are we seeing it sort of across the state, or is that something unique to state government?
Well, it's more likely to happen at the state government level simply because the departments are larger and there's more discrete potential subunits within a large department. But it's been happening here since at least the 2006 time period when we received a lot of requests to create sub-bargaining units at Department of Corrections, Fish and Game. I think there was even a Highway Patrol Bureau for a short period of time until that bureau was eliminated by a statutory change. So it's been a recurring activity over the last 15 years. And there certainly the employer has every right to come in and file all the objections available to them, and they get evaluated as part of the decision-making process. Yeah.
Thank you. Do we have any questions on the phone? Seeing none, I would thank Director Ingersoll for the presentation and for his continued work. I would now like to call our next group, and we're almost back on schedule, the Governor's Commission on Disabilities.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Director. Good afternoon. Can we both be able to introduce yourselves for the record and then begin your presentation?
Yes. Good afternoon. I am Chuck Thayer, the Executive Director of the Governance Commission on Disability, and seated to my left is, and I'll ask her to introduce herself.
My name is Phyllis Harrington. I'm the Business Administrator.
Yeah. And thank you all for this opportunity, Mr. Mayhew, if I pronounced that correctly. Nice to meet you. Director Zellum, great to meet you and see you again. Michelle, also, and Mr. Bouchard. And again, thank you to all of you and to the governor for the opportunity to present on what we refer to as GCD, the Governance Commission on Disability. I do have a handout. Handout is 5 pages long. I won't go into detail in the handout, so I'll attempt, Director Mayhew, to get you back on schedule as I can, and we'll give a very high level view. So the Governance Commission on Disability is an executive branch agency directly within the governor's office. And it seeks to serve, and it's statutory mandated, to serve individuals with disabilities in the state of New Hampshire. And I stress that it's a cross-disability executive branch agency. All of you may be aware that there are various forms of disability, individuals with autism, individuals who are blind, individuals with developmental or intellectual disabilities. So when we look at the GCD, it truly is the resource for all disabilities. As of the latest UNH Institute on Disability statistics for New Hampshire, it averaged from 2013 to 2017. There were roughly 165,000 individuals with a disability reporting in New Hampshire. That's about 12.6% of the New Hampshire population, which is actually consistent with the national average. The GCD sets to serve as a source of resources, information, referrals, and consultation as it deals with the Americans with Disabilities Act. So the way I look at it, when you think of the ADA in the context of New Hampshire, the Governance Commission on Disability is truly the ADA resource for the state of New Hampshire. The GCD is not as large as some other agencies, but I have to tell you, and I say this with an incredible amount of passion and care, GCD is pivotal to the state government, and I'm passionate about what we do. The resources and the help and the pro forma, I should say, informal mediation that we put forward to resolve various matters, truly is an example of what the GCC does for the entire state government. The ADA is a national monumental piece of federal legislation enacted in 1990, which eliminated discrimination against a person with a disability, essentially a civil rights bill. It has five titles. At the GCC, and you see this across the nation also, there are three major titles. Title I deals with employment. Title II deals with the applicability of the ADA to state government and municipal government and county government. And Title III deals with public accommodations. A public accommodation is any private business which is open to the public, a hotel, a restaurant, a doctor's office. They have to be ADA compliant. To be sure, we're not an enforcement agency, but we are an agency that seeks to ensure that we educate. We've always had the opinion, and it's sort of the mantra of the GCD, we're here to bring the parties together so that we can all learn together. And I think there is an innate wanting on the public to learn, and you know, what do they have to do under the mandates? And we think of physical accessibility. But do I need a sign language interpreter? Do I have to provide a cot recording? Is it a service animal? I'm an individual with a disability, and we're seeing this now. We're seeing an influx of these interactions. With the COVID crisis, does an employee now have, can they now request an accommodation because of COVID within the workforce? So again, we are made up of 6.5 currently individuals. We have 6 full-time and 1 part-time. And 3 are specifically, excluding myself, directly related to the Americans with Disability Act and UNFCCA. On pages 2 and 5, two and three, it gives a highlight of what the GCC does. But I'd like to highlight a program that's in New Hampshire and is known as Stable New Hampshire. Stable New Hampshire is the Achieving Better Life Experience Act Savings Account. ABLE was enacted 5 years ago at the federal level in, 3.5 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, it might be 2016, at the state level, where New Hampshire now has its own ABLE Savings Program. It's governed by the IRS rule 529A, very similar to the 529 plan. And ABLE accounts allow individuals with disabilities to save money tax-free without jeopardizing needs-based benefits like Medicaid. That's a game changer. That's truly a game changer, and I have to tell you, New Hampshire has embraced that. When the legislation was enacted in New Hampshire, it named the executive director of the Governor's Commission on Disability and the state treasurer to administer the program. There were no general funds associated with the state of New Hampshire in any form. The GCD, in conjunction with the state treasurer, and I worked with my predecessor, Bill Dwyer, in presentations and ensuring that we promoted this program, if I may use that term loosely. We currently have 414 accounts in the state of New Hampshire. We have nearly $2.7 million in New Hampshire assets under advisement, under management. The program is managed by Stable, which is in Ohio. We actually contracted with Stable on a 5-year contract to actually run the program. It's a showpiece for New Hampshire. And the fact that with the limited resources that we all have in state government, we're all aware of that, the fact that we're able to continually promote this product is truly what I would consider a shining example. And I know Commissioner Stewart said it. New Hampshire figures out a way to do things. And I got to be honest with you, we have to always think out of the box. So again, I'd like to reiterate that we're coming up on the 3-year anniversary. We hope to break 500 by year end. I don't know, incredible uptick, even during the pandemic. With the ABLE accounts. We chip along at about 7 new accounts a week. That's pretty good. And we do virtual presentations. I recently sat in on the Cancer Bar Association continuing legal education to work closely with attorneys with special needs trusts because ABLE accounts and special needs trusts are in the end. So from all my soapbox, I'm really proud of Stable, and I'm proud of what Stable gets to offer to New Hampshire residents. Any reduction on our budget, and I know you all people will have an impact. We have 600 individuals, and like I said, a top timer. And we have seen, in my tenure, I've been in the position for 7 years, consistently over 7 years, what we have done, and there are certain things that I'd like to look back on. I don't believe state government should be siloed. I believe that we should all work together. And as small as the DCD is, we're accomplishing that. I work closely with Commissioner on staff, closely with DMV. State agencies are reaching out for the assistance. And I got to tell you, I get excited about that, because that's what this is all about. We have to learn how to work in an environment collaboratively. And, you know, egos check at the door, and I say that to myself also. Having said that, the GCD under my tenure has always maintained a streamlined budget. I have truly enjoyed my relationship with Matt over the years. We've always given lapses that were consistent with a budget that was created in a streamlined fashion. Currently, because of the fiscal constraints in the current fiscal year, we have reassigned a full-time worker employee over to GOFA. And truthfully, that's a win-win, because it was able to help the GCD, so now that those funds can now last over. And I thank Commissioner Jared Little, who worked closely, and again, Director Bell on that. The GCD, I'll do a very high level. We have three accounting units, numbered 1004, 1006, and 1007. I'll skip to 1006, which is entirely 100% federal fund, has one full-time employee in that position, and she handles all of the Title I employment questions. I anticipate Commissioner Hollenhouse that she will grow in her relationship with personnel, now that we're in the same building. 1007 has what we refer to as the telecommunications accounting unit. There's a TEEP program, Telecommunications Equipment Assistance Program, statutorily GCD receives $96,000 a year, and we typically put out to bid every 2 years up to $92,250. And those are directly, they come from the PUC's Relay Service Trust Fund. And for the other $31,500, totally a pass-through. The predecessors who were in the room from DNCR, the state librarian was there, and we were closer to the talking block in Newsline for the Blind, which allowed individuals with disabilities to read newsprint. We did meet our 10% target. There was a lot of number crunching. In reaching the 10% target, I had to unfund a full-time position. At the GCD. We also incurred extra expenses to the tune of about $18,000 in the first fiscal year, and in the second year, by the end, about $26,000. And again, we see it across state government, the Class 10, Class 5 employees, and we see it in Venice, Class 60. And this time around, we also saw it in Brent. Over the summer, the governor repurposed the building where we were. Now we've got a wonderful neighbor in the Division of Personnel, and we entered into a lease arrangement with Personnel. And, you know, if I may give a plug to Adam, you know, I got to tell you, I have the utmost regard for Commissioner Hollenhouse as a mentor, as an incredible intellect, easy to work with. They have made it nothing short of easy to get along with in the new environment. So that's why I do thank the Commissioner.
I like that department. As do we.
So having said that, we did meet the target. We also incurred the extra expense of the $18,000 in the first fiscal year. Can it be done under the current budget that is proposed? The GCD will make it happen. And I stand stalwart on that, and I always have. Whatever has to be done, be it stable and no general funds and no employees, we'll get it done. I respect the request. If there is a possibility to review that, and perhaps that there's further discussions on that, I'm not sure. But, you know, as I stated in the early part of the presentation, because we're so small and because the amount of calls that have come into the GCD by way of email and just basic calls and walk-ins and individuals looking for assistance, we would love to revisit that. you know, I understand it and I take it to heart that I have to be a good steward in the position I'm in, and I strive for that every day. I want to be a good steward of the state's money. And I understand that we have to reduce the footprint, because that's necessary. These are unprecedented times. And everyone in their own house is doing the same thing, and I understand that. We're all at the kitchen table figuring out the budget. So if there is an option to reconsider that, we welcome the discussion. What we did do in the budget, we did increase our class 50, because when we were able to unfund the position, we looked at the overall benefits and the salary that was commensurate with that, and we were able to build in class 50 monies. If we were to have to go that way, overall, it's a lean budget. We at the time, I'm very happy about that. With that, I won't take up any more of the time. I do want to thank Ellison. It is a personal thank you. He is truly been dedicated to the disability community, especially and really across the board, but highlighted in mental health, which we all know what the strides have been made there, as well as development of disability forum. I will tell you the GCD per HB4 in the last budget had to come up with a report where we made recommendations to the status of the developmental disability agencies and how the work is getting done. Not so much to call out the DD agency, but more, can we make a group system even better? It's a great product that's on our website, and we were honored that the GCD was entrusted to produce that report. I thank you to the staff of the GCD, because I will be the first one to admit, and again, I'll follow Charlie. I'm only as good as them, and they are phenomenal. It's a steady staff. They have been no turnover in staff. They are the workhorses when it comes to the GCD. So, with that, I welcome any questions, and I welcome the opportunity to continue the discussion.
Thank you, Director Sayer. Do we have any questions for Commissioner Arlenkos?
You do a great job, but let's be honest.
It is. I would imagine. Oh, man, she keeps me on my toes, but I'm happy about that. From here, is my time straight? That too. Did I think of this outright?
Very important to do.
Yeah.
The position that to get the 10% of target is unfunded, it's an affiliate position?
Yeah. Meaning, is there a person in it?
Yeah.
And in full disclosure, and I should have referenced this, the position is remaining at the GCD unfunded, meaning the position is not going.
But there wouldn't be anybody in it. Okay. I wanted to make that clear.
Sure.
If I'm right about where it's going, it's in the position that affects a bunch of things like leases. It does, and they're timely because they have to go through there.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it deals with the physical and architectural accessibility that we work so closely with the Department of Administrative Services, as it deals with system agencies and the courts and et cetera.
Thank you, Director Sayer. Do we have any questions on the phone?
If you have a question, please go ahead and start.
While we wait for that, Director Zell.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Philip. So it's good to see you guys. I'm very reticent to ever speak for the government, but I feel very confident that I can speak for them in this space. I talked earlier in the day about some of the government does lots of things, but there are some things that are more fundamental to our core mission. And specifically, we're talking with Commissioner Hanks around corrections and a restorative justice system. But providing services to our citizens who have different levels, who are disabled and have different levels of ability, who are differently able, is so fundamental and core to what a government does, and being able to remove barriers and ensure equal access to services and resources, and it provides dignity. And then so much of what the government does is a core of we're trying to provide people the ability and the space to realize their full potential, which is inherently an attempt to enable the dignity of everyone. And the work that your agency does, while you're a very small agency, and oftentimes our conversations are consumed with some of the government jumps from crisis to crisis, more highly of you and your team, as well as your ability to collaborate across the government, because unfortunately we are somewhat siloed. And I think your efforts. It's your ability to find collaboration is something that we need. It's a really a model that we need to build off of. And I know that this is an area the governors are focused on, and you'll be having many conversations with my successor, Matt, about how we can build off of the success we've already seen. I do have one technical question on that statement. The telecommunications program, is the transfer from the Relay Service Fund fixed in statute? I seem to recall that it's been 92.5, or the last couple of times I've looked at it.
Yes, so it is fixed in statute, and the statute recites $96,000. Typically, the contract of the RFP would offer $92,250. And $3,750 is retained at the DCD as operating costs for management of the program and for truthfully for Phyllis to meet with the contractor on a monthly basis, audit the book, so to speak, and ensure that the inventory and that the population is being served.
I just asked this question because earlier in the year, the governor conducted a inventory of state programs, and there are many programs throughout state government and agencies that are incredibly impactful on communities, and I wonder how much we actually interact and engage. And so, if there's a program for the blind that is run at the Department of Education, and this program, I'm just wondering how much of class collaboration between kind of pocketed state resources where we dedicate resources to a cause to ensure that we're really being able to leverage and maximize the public investment. So that's kind of more of a statement, but I think oftentimes there's a discussion in the legislature, I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but there's a fight to get something done, and once it happens, kind of forget about it, and it kind of behooves us to go back and look at it and say, well, is that really the right amount? Is that the correct spend given the need? And if it's not the correct spend, where else are we spending funds that we could use to leverage that to really get the biggest bang?
I do agree. Thank you, Matt, for that.
Anything further for the Governor's Council on Disability? Or Commission on Disability?
Yeah.
My apologies.
No, that's okay.
Yeah. I look forward to your committee, Director Shea, and I will get the name right in the future.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Mayor Zellum, Director Zellum, I should say, Commissioner Hollingham, Commissioner Boucher. Thank you all. Great. Thank
you. You as well.
Thank you.
Any questions on the phone?
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Charlie.
We haven't had a question on the phone. We had like one question the first presentation the first day, and then
that's it.
Huh? We're going 30 seconds.
Not you.
We're supposed to do it without a question on the phone.
Jared, thank you.
With that, I'd like to bring forward the Office of Strategic Initiatives for their presentation. They are here in person.
I think I should do this just in case.
Thank you,
John. I'll use the other side again.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. For the record.
Oh, go ahead. It's good to see you here. I would not have been myself being in this position, but welcome. If you could introduce yourself to the record.
Sure. So my name is Jared Chacoine. I'm the director of the Office of Strategic Initiatives. And joining me today is Jane Lanier. She's the business director at OSI. And I'd just like to say I could not do my job without Jane. So she is someone who in this last year, we have three folks in our business office, and one of them was essentially four terminal illness. So Jane has been working lots of extra hours to make sure OSI functions. So very thankful for her help, and glad that we're going to be here today. I'm looking at your familiar faces. I know you already know quite a bit about what we do at the Office of Strategic Initiatives. I did provide a handout for you, which includes an overview I will start with, and then just some talking points about the next budget. So, and for the benefit of those on the phone, I'm just going to go through the overview briefly here and touch some of these points. So, at the Office of Strategic Initiatives, we have two divisions, planning and energy. In our planning division, we have a state data center, which since 1982, OSI has maintained an MOU with the U.S. Census Bureau to staff and operate the state data center. Responsibilities include supporting each decennial census. The SBC also prepares population estimates and projections. The most critical of these tasks is the requirement that OSI prepare annual population estimates that are used to distribute the rooms and meals tax revenue to municipalities. An important function that I don't think many folks know we do at OSI. And this year was busy with the census. So that is our work there is pretty much wrapped up at this point. We also have the Municipal and Regional Assistance Program. The MRA includes activities to meet our responsibilities to staff boards and commissions. So the Council on Resources and Development, which I chair, the Wetlands Council, of which we are a member, and to provide training and assistance to local land use boards. We currently have two planners that work in MRA. We have the Conservation Land Stewardship Program. This program monitors 176 conservation easements throughout the state to ensure that they are managed properly. The CLSP is funded by interest income from the CLS endowment at Treasury and through transfers from DES, Fish and Game, and the Department of Agriculture Resources for the monitoring that we perform for those agencies. So we have contracts with those three agencies to do that. We also have the National Flood Insurance Program. We're the state coordinating office for NFIP. We provide technical assistance and training to municipalities and homeowners regarding flood insurance and floodplain management, and we participate in the mapping projects. Moving over to our energy division, we have the Fuel Assistance Program, which I'm sure most folks are aware of. Through the FAP program, OSI distributes federal funds to community action agencies to cover a portion of the heating needs of low-income households. Current funding is estimated to be approximately $26 million and typically serves about 36,000 households. I think last year it was less than that. We also, and the average benefit in this handout says $650. And that's actually, I think we're closer to about between $800 and $900 for an annual benefit. And I would also add that we did receive additional CARES Act funding for LIHEAP, which will go towards a supplement for those qualifying households this winter, equal to about roughly $200. So we're happy to be able to provide that to those households. And I would also just note that the community action programs, the five community action programs, do a great job administering this program for us. So it's we have a good working relationship with them. And this year with COVID and everything else going on, it's just a lot of extra work to get these households the applications in, interview them, certify, and make sure that those awards are made. Moving on to weatherization. OSI contracts with community action agencies to conduct energy audits and to weatherize low-income households. We typically receive about $1.4 million each program year, and we serve on average about 212 or so households that we're able to weatherize. We also utilize some of the federal LIHEAP funds for heating repair and replacement programs for weatherization. So we are allowed, the federal government allows that. So in the next program year, I think we're looking at about $1.5 million in LIHEAP funds going to weatherization and building weatherization. So excited about that opportunity. We also have the state energy program. The SEP program utilizes federal funds for analysis, education, and programs to reduce energy usage and costs and increase clean energy opportunities. We also work on energy policy for the governor's office, which is an important part of what we do. We also have SHOP, which is the state heating, oil, and propane program. OSI participates in this data collection program to provide fuel price information to the Energy Information Administration of the U.S. Department of Energy. OSI tracks prices for multiple heating fuels and provides regular updates via our website for consumer comparisons. It's a helpful tool, so I would encourage folks to check that out on our website to see where energy prices are going this winter. And there's other energy grant opportunities that we have administered over the years. One that we're typically working on is a school energy efficiency grant program that has been very well received. We've been able to help to this point, I think, three schools. We're on our third project with that program, weatherizing schools. So important work there. So with that, that's sort of a high-level overview of the two divisions at our office and what we do. I think moving on to the second page of your handout, any questions, sorry, before we move on to this?
I do have a question. Thanks, Jared. And this is more of a, I would like to update the National Flood Insurance Plan. It's been my understanding that the flood maps were last done in the 1980s. And that we are currently, the nation is in the process of updating the flood control maps. Where are we in New Hampshire in conjunction with FEMA and the Army Corps and the National Flood Insurance Program in actually updating this?
So that's a great question. We're in the process. I have to check for sure. There's been a lot of things going on around the mapping, including training that we've been doing. So I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't want to speak out of turn. There's a lot going on with that program right now.
Okay, thank you. Yeah,
I will say that we're working very close with communities, and we pride ourselves in that. And actually, with COVID, one of the silver linings, I think, is the fact that we're doing more web-based training, and I think allows those folks who serve on volunteer boards in the community to participate in some of this. So anyway, just one bright spot.
It's just something that, as every homeowner in the state, essentially impacted.
Yes,
and it behooves everyone to have accurate information, and so it's a shame of the country that it's taken almost 40 years to update our maps. And so I know your agency is leading our state effort.
Yeah.
So the sooner we can have done, the better, obviously.
And making sure that we have the correct information.
Yeah.
It's key. So
another question. Thank you, Jared, for your presentation thus far. Steph, which of course is the program manager here, to me and my pathway. I know we funded here in New Hampshire with TBE funds. I also believe that most states have exhausted those funds. Do we know, is that a long-term strategy or will that eventually run out?
It will run out. Actually, I'll look at Jane. If you know the number off the top of your head, how much we have left?
We are close to $506,000 left. And we spend approximately $50,000 a year as that.
So we're looking roughly a decade still before that would be at current level.
Yeah, about. But our STEP grants are going up, therefore our 20% match is also going up. So.
Thank you.
Still not bad considering it's a result of the 1980s, I believe, settlement. So.
Is it for belief?
Yes, we do.
I have a question actually on that as well. It mentions the work the program engages in with the Nuclear Decommission Finance Commission,
mm-hmm.
which is modeled that I think New Hampshire. The way we set up our financing for the decommissioning of the Seabrook Station is a model for the rest of the country. We are been widely successful. Does OSI engage with the with oversight of nuclear beyond just financing? And we do have a state nuclear assessment, which is at the Department of Safety for public safety purposes. But other than the deep decommissioning financing, which is completely separate. Is there any work from the department that could realistically be built to the nuclear assessment?
Not that I'm aware of. This is the only involvement we have on any issue related to Seabrook or nuclear energy in general. Is the seat that we have there.
Continue.
Okay, great, thank you. Just page two of your handout, I just want to hit the highlights on our 22-23 budget. So if you look at page 121 of the activity book, the budget book, if there are we all on the same page of those, by the way, I think you should see our organizational chart on 121.
I believe on our end it's page 33.
Okay. Okay.
I have
a copy
as well. It's okay. We've been a recurring guy. But yeah.
Okay. All right. Great. So I'll go there quickly. Just say that we have 11 classified positions within OSI and 10 non-classified. Those non-classified positions serve at the pleasure of the governor. So you can see our organization chart there. And then just looking at current vacancies. We do have 5 vacancies right now, one our admin secretary, one in our finance office or business office, the conservation and stewardship program, we have an opening for the specialist position there, and then we have 2 vacancies in the energy division, state energy program manager, and fuel assistance.
And Director Fisher, what's the breakdown of classified versus not classified of those vacancies?
So the admin secretary and the finance position are both classified, as well as the CLS position, the conservation and land stewardship program specialist. And the 2 energy positions are non-class, so 3 classified and 2 non-class. And I would also mention that the conservation and land stewardship program specialist position is not funded by general funds. Those are the just an overview of our current vacancies. Looking at sort of the budget, the comparison, the highlights on the percentage of our budget. So FY21, the percentage of general funds in our budget, 3.2%, almost 3.3%. We were able to get that down to 2.9% in fiscal year 22 and $1,091,000 in fiscal year 23, which is an increase, but that's the result primarily due to several classified employees that would be receiving step increases. We were able to achieve these general fund reductions through the following things. OSI has elected to leave our admin secretary position vacant and unfunded in the 22-23 biennium. This position is funded by means of its general funds and a mix of federal funds. Some staff will be allocated to SAFE and those expenses directed to federal programs. So spend some of their time on federal grant programs. We also reduced our current expenses and equipment expenses while increasing other funds and federal fund revenues. We have 2 prioritized needs. One is a DOIP request, and one is a DAS request. So those are the 2 that we have. Those are some highlights. Happy to take questions.
Commissioner Ross.
Hi, nice to see you. Across state government, almost everybody's a classified employee, except for 350 or whatever it is, unclassified employees, and the legislative branch. And the governor's office is its own weird thing, too. And the only other place that this weirdness exists is OSI, where you have, and so every time there's a new governor, there's an incoming thing where the entire governor's office is cleaned out, right? Because that's the way that works. And then you'll go in, I remember this from 4 years ago, somebody went in and met with, I think Jamie ever met Pam Walsh, and she went, yeah, so there's nine positions at OSI that are not classified. But five of them aren't really, only four of them are. And those four people are all prepared for residency that they did. And then, you know, new government picks one. But five of them aren't really unclassified in that while legally you have the right to say, you know, traditionally we don't do that to people. I suspect the people in those positions, while they're comforted by that, are troubled by it too. There are discussions periodically about converting the not really unclassified people to really not unclassified anymore. Was there any consideration of that?
So it's a discussion that has happened, I think maybe once or twice in the last couple of years. And I don't think that we've ever come to a consensus with the governor's office on what to do there. I think it's another opportunity, this budget, possibly, to do that. For example, Jane's not classified. She's a business director and does a great job and has just that institutional knowledge with all the programs, federal grant programs that we administer. It's a big job. Yet she is in that non-classified position. So, yes, there seems to be, over the last decade or so, very little turnover with folks that have that crucial function within OSI, that job they do is so important. It doesn't mean it couldn't happen in the future. So I'm open to those, to conversations on that, but I think ultimately the governor's office needs to decide what the position will be.
Okay.
Just to piggyback on that, Jane, how many governors have you served for?
I've only been with the state for 10 years. Governor Lynch was in when I started. So
it's a testament that it does go across administrations, across parties, within the same party. Any questions on the phone for OSI?
If you have a question, please press star and star.
Seeing down there, just I guess on a census, you know, we have once every several budget cycles that we talk about the census. How does that go? How many New Hampshireites are officially counted?
So I would have to check on the exact number. The percentage I'm pretty sure was close to historically what we do. COVID, of course, created a lot of challenges. I know that in just the last couple weeks that before the deadline where those in the field operations had to stop. I know on my road on one day taking a walk with my kids, I ran into two census takers. We're like, do you know where these people live? And well, not any names, but help me find this address on this road, you know, and you could tell that they were under a lot of pressure to get this done and obviously with difficult circumstances, but I think they did a very good job considering everything that was going on.
I think I read a report from the U.S. Census Bureau that we were like 99.9%. They thought they counted in this state, but I have no idea how they calculated it. But if that's true, that's a testament to the federal state partnership for OSI and the Census Bureau.
How would you know? Like, if you know it's 99%, don't you know the number?
Yeah, this is really kind of radical. But my understanding is that there's models that are built given. Population growth trends, and so there's a enumeration target that every state gets of how many people they expect to be there, and then they're all shooting to get as close to 100% of what the model produced, and there's a tolerance that's like 1%, so anything over 99, they feel like, okay, after when the date comes where we feel comfortable that we've enumerated everyone who we're constitutionally required to enumerate, who's actually. So we've enumerated everyone.
I'll leave you with this one final question, potentially on the topic of stimulus dollars from the federal government. I know looking back to the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, a good
portion of those dollars were funneled through what was then OEP and now OSI. Is the department preparing in any way for a similar influx of funds?
So I think that once I can get these vacancies filled, sure. No, I think put that in there. You know, we were given the broadband grant program through Gopher using CARES Act funds, and that was a big lift. We were able to get it done, but it consumed quite a bit of time for our office. So anytime we had something, especially in a business office, it's a challenge. So we would need more people, which I think in those RA years, our office had north of 30 employees and two floors in Johnson Hall. So we're now down to, 15 filled positions, and we're on one floor in that building. So it would require an expansion, I think, to take on a project of that size.
Can I do one more?
Sure.
Commissioner Armas.
First of all, if you need more room, I can figure that out.
Thank you.
We were discussing the DOT earlier, vehicle replacement costs, and I almost forgot about this, but VW. So the VW settlement at some point, I remember discussions a long time ago when it was first blame in people's eyes, a discussion about their sort of legitimate pre-existing safety needs and addressing them. And I felt like there was, like DOT was going to get a huge, we were going to replace a lot of vehicles. It sounds like it's only a few million that's going their way, but I gather there's a bunch of money left, unspoken for. I'm worried that that money is going to get diverted somehow to non-pre-existing state needs and new spending as opposed to taking care of existing priorities.
So it's a great question. We have, in our state mitigation plan, which we had to submit to Wilmington Trust, in our state mitigation plan, we allocated, $6.2 million to state vehicle replacement. I'll get back to you on exactly what the number is, but we have spent, I think, to date, with DOT, maybe $3.2-3.3 million on truck replacement, and then with other state agencies, about $1.5 million. So we're a little over $4 million on vehicle replacement. We have to abide by our mitigation plan, but we can amend it. So if you read our statewide mitigation plan, the money is accounted for in the mitigation plan. We're going to spend X amount on this or a percentage on that, for instance. The fast charging electric vehicle equipment, we're looking at the governor decided we would spend up to 15% on that effort. So we've got that in there. But so we could technically, yes, we could make adjustments to the mitigation plan if the governor's office were to allow that. But we have to stick to the plan in the interim.
Thank you.
Say thank you to OSI, and we will move on to our next presentation.
Thanks.
Great to see you all. Good to see you as well, Jared. We're now hearing from the Fish and Game Department, and I believe we have an Executive Director, Scott Mason, on the phone. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, and you may begin your presentation.
Okay. I'd just like to share our mission statement with you folks. As guardians of the New Hampshire fish, wildlife, and marine resources, the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department works in partnership with the public to conserve, manage, and protect these resources and their habitats, inform and educate the public about these resources, and provide the public with opportunities to use and appreciate these resources. Due to COVID-19, more and more people have chosen to recreate in the outdoors. This year, we have seen an increase in almost all of our services that we provide to the people of New Hampshire. Like all state agencies, we have tightened our budget due to the economic impacts that COVID is having on our state's resources. It will be hard for us to meet all of the historic needs and these increased needs that citizens are currently asking for with this proposed budget. Some of the other things that we're trying to do is we are reaching out to other state agencies, such as DANSA, to work on OHRV issues to try to reduce some of their issues and also some of ours, and also reaching out to some of the private organizations in trying to promote safe hiking habits to try to reduce some of our search and rescue expenses. Well, I've only been here for a short few months. It has become very apparent to me in this short period that the department is critically resource challenged from both a personnel side and from a financial side. We have 192 full-time positions, including myself. At this time, 9 of those positions are unfunded and 13 are vacant. We currently have 5 open CO positions. We have open positions at our hatcheries, at our public education programs, and within our biology divisions. Each and every one of these positions are critical to our mission. We ended fiscal year 2020 with a little better than $7.6 million in the Fish and Game Fund. Unusually high revenues in the spring of 2020. I think everybody knows that we were one of the few state agencies to actually see an increase in income due to the pandemic. This was a phenomenon that was recognized all across the nation. It's too early for us to tell at this point. The numbers haven't been able to challenge the numbers for what we're looking at for fall license sales. During the budget process, we were unable to meet the governor's original targets, which were 95 and 96.5 of the current fiscal year Fish and Game Fund budget appropriation. We did make major cuts across all divisions in our operating costs, and we unfunded 10 positions affecting 4 of our 7 divisions. After making these drastic cuts, we received approval of our target from the governor's budget director. Current fiscal year 2021 overall budget is $34 million. Fiscal year 22 and 23 is $33.88 million and $35.12 million respectively. And of course, like all state agencies, we're looking at 27 pay periods in the second year of the biennium. General fund appropriations have helped Fish and Game Fund over the last 4 biennium. Our budget request this year is $600,000 each year of general fund money. $100,000 of that is to match our non-game species program per RSA 212B6 Roman numeral 2, and $500,000 to law enforcement AU 7887. The budget's director provided this figure of $1.2 million over the biennium to us. We did not budget for the full request of DOIT. We were expecting to budget less in operating costs, so it seemed logical that they would send us a lower budget. What we did budget was for our current fiscal year, and we have engaged discussions with DOIT, although late in the process, those discussions continue. We did not budget any requests in the additional prioritized needs. This is not due to not having any. Frankly, it was very hard to prioritize one need over another since we started cutting operational costs within divisions. Since we did not cut out whole programs, we did not feel it necessary to add anything into the prioritized needs. Do you folks have any questions?
Thank you, Director Mason, for the presentation. Do we have any questions for Fish and Game? Director Zahn.
Thank you, Scott. The Fish and Game Department has somewhat of the unique
privilege of being an agency that is funded from its own fund, which is a major state fund. So typically in the budget process, it is the first agencies we try to close out with the governor's phase. Obviously, you know, you all know this better than anyone. We have to match the appropriations to the records that are coming in. And as we learn more and get a better idea of where fish and game revenues will land, as by any means, I'll speak to my successor, Matt, that we can inform, and then there's always the ability to revisit the levels of appropriation for the department. But I just want to say that I know that we've had multiple conversations, and you and Kathy have done an excellent job of really finding areas to make reductions while still maintaining the important services that the department provides. So, but the unenviable position of having to cut everywhere, I think by doing so, you've maintained your core functionality.
Thank you.
Do we have any questions on the phone for Fish and Game?
You have a question? We've
seen him on the phone. I would just say that I think I, like many of the state, have learned a lot about the good work of our conservation officers from the television show. I question for you, Executive Director, does the state receive any funding as part of that filming?
I believe the television show, they pay the New Hampshire Wildlife Foundation $2,000 per episode, and that goes into the Wildlife
Heritage
Foundation's funds, and then that organization writes grants back to Fish and Game for specific items and things. They support, as you may or may not be aware, we have some highly trained dogs that the COs use for search and rescue, for gathering evidence, and they support that program heavily, among other programs.
Thank you for that. Do we have any further questions for Fish and Game? Seeing none, I'd like to thank you both for your time and presentation, and I look forward to working people moving forward.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye.
With that, we will move on to hear from the Hampshire Retirement System. I believe they're joining remotely. Do we have Executive Director Lagos on the phone?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you very much. I'm George Lagos, Executive Director, and also on the line with me today is Gerard Murphy, our Director of Finance, Larry Johansson, our Director of Investments, and Marty Carlin, who's our Director of Communications and Legislative Affairs. Before I get going, I just want to confirm you have two handouts from us, an overview document and a strategic planning document. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Great. So I won't be speaking to the strategic planning document in the interest of time, but I'm happy to take questions on it. I will make a couple of remarks and then go to the overview document, and then I'll turn it over to Gerard to talk about the budget. So first of all, our mission is to provide secure retirement benefits and superior service. And for those of you who have heard this presentation before, it's substantially similar, although we still have many challenges ahead. We are pleased with the progress we've made over the past year. We presently have around 48,000 members, 39,000 retirees and beneficiaries, and the pension trust is managed by 13 trustees, and investment oversight is provided by an independent investment committee, which has 6 members. As fiduciaries, the trustees and the IIC members are all obligated to act solely in the interest of the system's members and beneficiaries. And with the exception of the state treasurer, who serves ex officio, the trustees and the investment committee members are all appointed through the governor and executive council. Our statutory administrative budget includes all internal, non-investment related administrative costs, including IT costs at full value. Pursuant to the statute, our board of trustees reviews and approves our statutory budget on a biannual basis. And our statutory administrative operating budget for fiscal 21 is $12.29 million. Our proposed budgets for the next 2 years are virtually flat at 12.31 million for fiscal 22 and 12.15 million for fiscal 23, and that's based on fully staffing all authorized positions. As you all well know, the retirement system is not an executive branch agency, but it's a statutorily created pension trust. And although our expenses do flow through the state, those costs are reimbursed from the retirement trust, which is in turn funded by contributions from employers, employees, and our investment returns. And as is always the case, the budget that's before you today was in fact vetted and approved by our Board of Trustees. A couple of final points before I go to the overview. We always like to have people remember that the retirement system actually provides a modest pension benefit. The annual benefit is just over $20,800. And two-thirds of our 39,000 members, retirees rather, receive less than $25,000 a year. Our investment returns over the past 25 years have been 7.5%. Second point is that our benefits help support the New Hampshire economy. In the last fiscal year, we paid out $816 million in pension benefits and $46 million in medical subsidy benefits. And just under 80% of our total retiree population still lives in New Hampshire, and they spend their money here. Third point is that there is a plan in place to pay down our unfunded liability, which everyone knows we've had a substantial unfunded liability for a number of years. There are 18 years remaining on the original unfunded liability, which will be paid off in 2039. And now we have a new amortization schedule for new gains and losses, where those gains and losses are going to be amortized out over 20-year periods every 2 years. And that's going to help mitigate volatility. It's also important to note that about 80% of the present employer contribution rate is actually allocated to fund the unfunded liability. Fourth point is that the trustees of the retirement system have continued to strengthen the plan by adopting revised actuarial assumptions recommended by the actuaries. That happened last in 2016, and it once again, with fiscal 19, there was another experience study, and again, the assumptions were revised. Most notably, our investment return was adjusted from 7.25 down to 6.75. Also, the payroll growth factor was reduced, as was the inflation rate. And all those things together resulted in increased employer contribution rates, which were recently certified by the board. Any questions so far? Okay. Hearing none, I'll just continue. I'm going to go to the highlights page now. There's a lot of content here. I won't go through every bullet, but I will cover the first half a dozen or so at the top and a couple of others as well. So speaking about the experience study, again, I just mentioned the assumed rate was adjusted down to 6.75. The inflation assumption was adjusted from 2.5 down to 2, and payroll growth was reduced from 3.75 to 3.25 for three of the member groups, and for teachers it was reduced from 2.75 to 2.25, recognizing that the number of teachers and the number of students continues to decline here in New Hampshire. COVID has affected us like everybody else. Presently, approximately 75% of our workforce is still working remotely. We continue in the ordinary course to get pension benefits out and to process retirement applications. On the investment side, for fiscal 20, our return was 1.1%, and the numbers are there for the 3, 5, 10, and 20-year, 25-year period. You can see they're 5.2, 5.9, 8.7, 5.4, and 7.5. So longer term, the results have been good. Last year was not a particularly good year for us. Compared to similarly situated pension systems, as determined by our investment consultants, we've performed better than 70% of our peers over the past decade, and all of our returns are net of fees. Contribution rates for fiscal 22 and 23, which were just certified, are going to increase overall by about 20% on average, which is a fairly sizable number. Employee group is the least. That's in the vicinity of 14%. Teachers was the highest, and police and fire was next. We're on an active outreach program right now where we're speaking to all stakeholder groups, explaining to them exactly how the experience study works and what the changes in the rates have been and why. And I think that's been very helpful to make sure everybody understands what the situation is. Finally, I'll just mention that the funded ratio on the plan is presently at 61% for the fiscal 2020. That's up marginally from 60.8% in fiscal 19. Moving down to the next section, some new initiatives we have going. We're creating a customer contact center, which is really the combination of a call center along with responsibilities for handling all of our general inbound emails, faxes, and also to handle all walk-ins when we once again return to having clients visit us at our offices. Along with that, we're adding some additional security to our caller validation process using LexisNexis, and we're very enthusiastic about that upgrade to our security. The third bullet I'll mention, because it's a significant project for us, it's with regard to the upgrade of our pension application, which is called Pension Gold. Right now we're on PG version 2 or PGV2, and we're now, it says 30%, but we're now 32% through the project to upgrade to version 3. The project's going to run for another 2 years or so, depending upon how many out-of-scope requirements get added as we go along. Significant challenges and opportunities. I think it's evident that the unfunded liability, together with adjustments to our assumptions, continue to be a challenge from the standpoint of employer rates. But the process is a good one. The trustees are very diligent, and as you would expect and want us to do, we rely very much on our actuaries in terms of the decisions we make. COVID-19 I addressed, so I'll leave that alone. And now I'm just going to make a couple comments about the budget and then give it to Gerard to go into the detail. So if you're looking at the page, the backside of the page or page 2, you can see a chart there that shows our budget process from 2013 to present. And I'll just focus, if I could, on the second line for the moment, the operations actual line. That's what we actually spent during each of the respective fiscal years. And if you go back to 2013, you can see that we were at 7.2. And this year, 2020, we were at 7.9 million. And the numbers moved around between those two numbers over that period of time. And that's despite the fact that, we have a union workforce and we negotiate every 3 years on the union contract and compensation adjustments have been in roughly the 3% area for a good majority of that time. So even with the increases with respect to employee costs and compensation, we've managed to stay within a very reasonable range, I think, over that period of time. The bottom line number, however, is a bit bigger. You can see just starting in 19 and 20, the PG version 3 project, was started in 19. And that's when we started seeing some expense come through. In 2020, you can see that our budget was 2.8. We spent 2.1. So the actual spending and budget numbers are at the bottom in bold at 12.1 and 10, respectively. With that, I'm happy to turn it over to Gerard, unless there's any questions that I can answer before I do that.
A number of questions at the moment, but a request. I don't believe we have the presentation that you're referring to, or at least in whole. If we could just receive that as a follow-up, that'd be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, I'll leave. I'm going to leave that to Gerard to respond to, because I know he dropped them off a day or two ago as requested. So I'm not quite sure what happened, but we'll certainly make sure you get them.
All right. Appreciate
and
it.
Gerard, other questions? Okay, then I'll turn it over to you, Gerard.
Okay, can you folks hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Did I hear that you folks do not have the handout? Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Okay, I am not sure what happened. I did drop them off yesterday, but Anywho, I will walk you through, as George said, just some high-level points on the budget. Let's see. The budget for 22-23 is relatively flat. We have a bottom-line increase, an annual increase in 22 that is 0.1% over 21, while in 23 the annual change was a decrease of 1.3%. For salaries and benefits, which comprise just over 60% of the NHRS operating budget, the annual increase in fiscal 22 is 3.2%, while it is 6.5% of an annual increase in fiscal 23. In the first year, the benefits are driving the increase due to increases in the pension contributions and employee medical insurance, while in the second year, the 27th payroll is the largest factor in the increase. Currently, NHRS has 71 authorized positions, and 62 of those are filled currently. The other major area of the budget I wanted to point out are the costs associated with the project, as George mentioned, to upgrade our pension administration software to Pension Goal Version 3. And the costs associated with this project represent almost 20% of this operating budget. We are projecting a 5.2% decrease in 22 over fiscal 21, and then a further decrease of 23.9% in fiscal 23. And the reasons for these decreases are twofold. The first is we've gotten through some of the larger upfront payments that we're making to our software provider for implementation. And the second reason is the personnel costs for the six positions associated with this project have come in less than what we assumed back when we originally budgeted for them a couple years ago. So really, just a high-level overview of the budget changes we're looking at for fiscal 22 and 23. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both for the presentation. One question, you referenced the performance this year was a bit lackluster compared to what's really a pretty good track record compared to our neighboring states and our peers. Could you just speak to that a little bit more and guess what challenges the pandemic had based on our testing strategy and how we might be able to reverse that or return to our longer term trends moving forward?
I'll ask Larry Johansson, who's, I believe, on the line to respond to that question. Larry?
Can you hear me?
There you are, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Essentially, the global pandemic for the first quarter of calendar 20 had an adverse impact on our performance as well as all of the capital markets. Our total fund was down 12% for the quarter. For the second quarter of calendar 20, the total fund was up 9.5%. For the third quarter of the calendar, it was up 4.7%. So essentially, we've almost rebounded completely in the second quarters after the first quarter. And continue to improve. So obviously a global pandemic is not an event anyone could have or did anticipate, but we have essentially recovered from that very dramatic down quarter in the first quarter of 20.
As a follow-up, is it fair to say that our states and our peer group experience either less dramatic declines or everyone roughly on the same playing field? Again, I know we have a 10-year track record that's stellar, just again curious on the environment we're in today and how our peer states are accounting for it.
I would say we were probably as dramatic in the first quarter in a downturn as everyone else. It's been a little more slow to recover, but we expect a full and complete recovery over time.
Thank you. Any other questions, Director Zeller?
Just a point of clarification. Is it the state that actually makes these payments and the trust reimburses the state? I'm looking at Commissioner Arlen. Do we handle the retirement system similarly to how we handle the division support of harbors? With my understanding that these payments never hit the state system and they're just reported in the state budget due to a legislative mandate, but it's in fact not the state treasury that makes them.
George, I can handle that one. The state, we do actually process the transactions through New Hampshire First. So yes, the in this budget do go through the state financial system, and then there is a reimbursement process. That's exactly correct.
Sorry, that was an administrative thing. Gerard, you pay us for them, though, don't you?
I don't believe so, Charlie. There is no payment arrangement for that service. That's correct.
As a follow-on to that, I know we were talking about non-classified positions within OSI, how some of those are, you know, whether or not non-class is the right description. If the state is paying, you know, these are 71 non-classified positions. Is that a similar conversation, Charlie, that we should look to?
I want to understand this better, because I didn't think we were counting in our employee counts.
I don't believe you are counting them. This is Gerard again. The personnel, the 71 positions over at NHRS do not flow through the Division of Personnel at DAS. We have our own HR folks who handle all of our personnel related matters.
There's a classification system too, don't you? Like 23 steps or something?
Well, we have 22 steps, yeah, but it's entirely outside the state personnel structure. We have our personnel policies and procedures are governed by an employee handbook that we adopted about 5 or 6 years ago, and that was something that was negotiated with the SEA during one of the contract negotiations before I got there. So it's entirely outside of the state system.
All right, I think we have that sorted out. Directors, Allen, with another question. I just want to note for the record, members of the committee, and for my own sanity, that we have two retirement systems in the state. We have the New Hampshire retirement system, and we have the judicial retirement system. And I know that you work closely with the judicial retirement system, but they are, in fact, a separate and independent entity from you all. As you are looking to update your pension goals system and utilize the best technological resources, will that resource be available to the much smaller judicial retirement system?
That's a very good question. We're looking at that. We haven't come to the judicial retirement plan to talk about that yet because based on the pricing with our vendor on that, it's very, very expensive proposition for the size of the plan. The judicial retirement plan is a standalone plan. We provide administrative services for them. They usually meet in our office space, and we provide sort of the back room to processing the pensions for them and their COLAs. And we do it a lot. There's a lot of manual process. But to automate that process is pretty close. It's a very big number, and it doesn't make any economic sense. We're probably going to have a conversation with them about it, but it's nothing that we're going to fund on our part because if we actually went through and did that in PGV3, our cost to the JRP would go up dramatically. We certainly would not. We couldn't do it for $50,000 a year, or whatever the fee is, under those circumstances. Because as a pension trust, you know, we have to use our assets and resources for the benefit of our members. So anything that we do for judicial retirement plan administratively has to be revenue neutral at best, or at least, let's say.
I fully understand that and appreciate that. And again, I would never want to rock either of they call, but I appreciate the conversation we'll have. And if that, if if there is a economy of scale that's affordable to the judicial plan that will realize that partnership.
Yeah. See, the actual problem is that the programming of these systems, you know, very much depends upon the benefit structure. And whereas the JRP plan is entirely different than our plan in terms of the membership and how the benefits are calculated and the provisions of the plan, it's basically like setting up an entirely new pension system within the vendor's product. And that requires a lot of design work, and therefore the expense is way out of line with the return.
Any questions on the phone for the Hampshire Retirement System?
Do you have a question?
Seeing none, I'd like to thank you both for the presentation and answering the questions. I look forward to working with both of you as we move forward through this process.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we'll make sure you get the material. Sorry that you didn't.
No worries. We do, just for the record, we do have one handout from the retirement system, but I don't believe it was the same material that you were referring to. So there might just be some cross wires here, but I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, we'll get it straightened out for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I would like to call on the Developmental Disabilities Council. I believe we have them calling in as well. Do we have Executive Director Rodriguez on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello, Executive Director Rodriguez. You may begin.
Hi, everybody. My name is Isadora Rodriguez-Legendre, and I am the Executive Director of the New Hampshire Council on Developmental Disabilities. You guys can hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, wonderful. So I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to present our budget. We did send over some packets, which had some handouts in them, and also sent the handouts separately. I'm not sure if you all have that.
We do have folders in front of us.
Excellent. So in your folders on the left-hand side, I've prepared just a little bit of information about the DD Council, and it has our mission on it, and our mission is full community inclusion and integration for all New Hampshire citizens with developmental disabilities, and we do our work primarily by collaborating with other organizations, and we collaborate on educational activities, advocacy activities, and we also use a good amount of our funds to provide financial resources for projects and grants that are infused directly into the community. So we don't provide direct services, but we do offer financial resources into the DD community through our small grants and larger demonstration grants. So those are bigger projects. We are created by the federal legislation known as the Developmental Disabilities Assistance and Bill of Rights Act, most recently reauthorized in 2000. And that means that we are 100% federally funded. We support public policies and initiatives that remove barriers and promote opportunities in all areas of life. We work closely with agencies that do provide services to see if there are ways that we can collaborate with them on initiatives and supports for the developmental disabilities community. And the other important thing to know is that we are a minimum allotment state. So based on a complex formula that I don't know the details about too closely, the Congress allocates our budget annually. And so in years like this one, where there is a continuing resolution, or other years if there's a government shutdown, it's important to know that we don't receive our full funding until the federal budget is enacted. And so I've also provided a copy of our most recent federal award letter, which shows that due to the continuing resolution, it's only a partial amount for our federal fiscal year. We usually get around $500,000 a year, so that you're aware of that. And so we do anticipate that when the federal budget is voted on, that we will get additional funds. So it's also important to note on our notice of award that our about $500,000 a year award has a two-year project period, which means that the feds allow us to carry funds forward from one year to the next, but they do expect that we will have obligated the full amount in a given year by the second year of that funding. And so our funds have kind of an expiration date, so to speak. And I point that out because of we were asked if the efficiency budget meets our needs. It does meet our needs, but because it's federal funds, that potentially budgeting less than 100% could put us in a position where we're returning unspent funds to the federal government that could have gone into our community with projects and grants. So other than that, our council is made up of volunteers. They don't get paid to be on our council. By law, by federal law, and we have a state enabling legislation that mirrors our federal language. 60% of our members have to be individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities or parents and guardians of individuals with developmental disabilities. And this ensures that the work that we do is driven by the community that we support. They're also partners named in statute that are on our council, including Voc Rehab and Special Education, the Institute on Disabilities, Disability Rights Center. I won't name them all, but they are gubernatorial appointments and they serve three-year terms. What we're charged with in the DD Act is identifying what the most pressing needs are for our community and then developing a five-year plan to help address those needs. And in our five-year plan, everything goes back to the five-year plan. So any project or activity that we do is in line with that five-year plan. So we, again, primarily work with other organizations on things like conferences and trainings and supports for direct support professionals. Most recently during COVID, we developed some grants that were based on emerging needs. So we were able to provide some facilities with PPE before it became available through the state. We were able to provide some agencies and facilities with technology that helped people access, web-based healthcare and also educational resources if they lacked technology to do so. So the only prioritized needs that we have on our budget are based on, as other agencies have said, on the DOIT increases. In general, we're a very small staff. We have three full-time positions and a few part-timers. And so we don't anticipate having any other prioritized needs, although if we had a wish list, if you are able to see on page 3 on our grants line, this year, because of COVID-related grant funds infused into the developmental disabilities community, we spent about $179,000, almost $180,000 on grants. And so if you look at our efficiency budget, we are actually, we have for 2022, $90,000, and 2023, $80,000. So if we had a wish list, we would put about $30,000 more into Class 72 to be able to directly impact individuals and families in the developmental disabilities community. I think that's about all I have for my presentation, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Good. Thank you both for the presentation. Do we have any questions for Executive Director Rodriguez Agenda? Commissioner Arons.
Hi, it's Norris. Charlie Arons. I hope you're well.
Thank you.
Thank you. So my question is, one, I'm hopeful that, I think if I understand your wish list need, it's that you're hoping for more federal grants and that could happen. And I hope for them too, and sure we could do an accept and expend if we get more federal money. And I wanted to ask you, though, in the current climate and during COVID, the community you serve is one that I think sometimes particularly struggles with things that are abstract and not concrete. And I'm wondering how, if you just give us a kind of a sense of for the people you work with, how you think COVID is, and certainly in the last 8 months, and how you think people are handling it.
Oh, that's a very big question. I can say that the developmental disabilities has been greatly impacted by COVID. As you may or may not know, a lot of our folks live in either group homes or nursing facilities, and even those that live in enhanced family care placements and with family members, they depend on day services out in the community. And so there is such an impact to social isolation because services have needed to change, right? Some of our folks can't tolerate masks, and so that has become an issue as well. Especially in terms of special education, we're seeing a lot of impact there with families who, were receiving a lot of resources and a lot of supports and therapies through the school system. And now, because each school system is each region or each district is doing it a little bit differently. Some families, unfortunately, are not receiving the same level of services that they would if their kiddos were in school physically. And so that has become a real concern for us as we move forward. We're hopeful that the Department of Education will continue, and they've done a great job so far, to try to assess what the needs are and help different districts address those needs, but I think we need to do a lot more. And then there's also the access to technology issue. There are parts of our state that are so rural that there's no broadband access, and so people can't do teletherapy, telehealth, they can't do remote learning, and so that has become an issue as well.
Thanks for that. I've noticed, we know a lady at church who does a lot of work in the Congress School District with, she's a full-time aide, and, her student can't be served telephonically and on Zoom calls and all that. And
yes.
The shutdown in schools is very hard, and I think, I like what you said about social isolation. I think for a lot of these kiddos and young adults, too, and I would say that I think that's true whether you're typical or atypical.
Yes.
So,
very hard too, because I think a lot of us are experiencing that today, probably even those of us on the phone right now.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner Arlington. I would just echo that I think broadband is top of mind for a lot of reasons, especially to the extent that we have additional federal dollars coming to the state. Anything further for the Developmental Disabilities Council? Director Zella.
Thank you, sir. Good to hear from you. I would echo what Charlotte said earlier about if, in fact, we do get additional federal resources that we can absolutely go, especially if that's at the timing of the budget enactment, to accept and expend. But please just keep informed as you all learn more specifically about the standalone bill, the federal budget reauthorization, or potentially any provisions that would affect your agency in any stimulus or emergency relief bills that are coming. Said this the GTD reports earlier. I think that the work that the state does on behalf the work the state does to ensure that individuals with developmental disabilities have the resources and the opportunities to realize their full potential, and really the government doing everything we can to ensure that they're treated individuals every all citizens are treated with dignity. Is really paramount and fundamental to what it means to be a government and why we have a government. And so I think that there's a lot of really good programs we have around the state that impact the population that you serve, your organization serves, and I think that we've made strides in the last few years increasing collaboration, and I would just thank you for your role in that. We're still moving forward to ensuring that if there's programs in different places that we can put the jigsaw puzzle back together even better to make sure that programs are complementary and supportive, and that if there are economies of scale that we can utilize federal resources or state resources, we're doing that better. But thank you and your team for your work, part of Grant Staters, but also to help break down some silos within state government.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Director Zellman. Do we have any questions on the phone?
If you have a question, please press star
one. Really holding out for at least one question today, but I'm afraid we might not get it. I would like to thank you both once again for the presentation. I thank you for your work in these very important populations. To echo Director Zellman's comments, and I look forward to working with you moving forward.
Thank you all.
With that, I'd like to move on to our final presentation today from the Department of Military Affairs and Veteran Services. Good to see you both.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm David Michalaitis, the Adjutant General for the Department of Military Affairs and Veteran Services.
General, if you could just turn on your microphone. Thank you.
Hi, Charlie.
For the record, I'm David Michalaitis, the Adjutant General for the Department of Military Affairs and Veteran Services. With me is Judy Chen, our Head of Accounting. In the back is Admiral Warren Perry, our Deputy Adjutant General, and our Zayak, our Business Administrator. So first and foremost, to give you sort of an overall perspective, we employ over 3,000 employees between the Department of Military Affairs and the New Hampshire National Guard. Those 3,000 employees, approximately 2,700 are uniformed men and women of both the Army and Air National Guard. We have 75 federal Department of Army and Department of Air Force civilians, to include 159 state employees who support the men and women of the National Guard in our veteran portfolio. Of the 159 state employees, 138 support the military affairs section, 21 support veteran services. So you look at what we do, it's more about the people and the facilities. So for example, the military affairs section of our portfolio we'd like to talk about first is it's all about the infrastructure and the modernization of our facilities. As we modernize our facilities in the past decade, it is going to testify hosting governor executive council at our annual cross training complex. We were building newer facilities on the Army side, a maintenance facilities in Rochester and Hooksett, a new armory in Pembroke, our regional training institute with the annual cross training complex in Pembroke, with additional part projects projected into the future in the next 3 to 5 years. you took all of that, and you look at our Air National Guard, we're the only Air Guard wing in the entire nation with this new KC-46 refueler. It's all about our traditional infrastructure. You have keys for building new hangars, new simulators, different support facilities. When you put it all together, what are our requirements or needs on the military affairs side of the house? It's infrastructure support, which is essentially personnel coming in our assemblies. When you look at the veteran service portfolio of which we have, it's 21 state employees doing the state veteran cemetery, the Division of Veteran Services, and the Division of Community-Based Military Programs. That is 21 employees. During this last legislative session, House Bill 1572, a veteran omnibus bill package, which included Senate Bill 7726, included what's called a Veterans Bill of Rights. When we did our fiscal note, in order to support that future legislation, it requires three new additional positions. What I should have mentioned earlier was, when you look at our employees on the veteran service portfolio, they're all 100% generally funded. When you look at the 138 state employees who support the New Hampshire National Guard, there's a different posture based upon where they reside, what their position is, and what they support. So those positions range from 100% general funds, a different 75, 25, 50, 50 federal state posture, then 100% federally reimbursed. So I do really need sponsors, infrastructure support for the men and women of the New Hampshire National Guard, and additional personnel support past legislation for additional veteran support functions. When you look at our efficiency budget, we hold the line at 4.89. When you look at our additional prioritized needs, that's where the rubber meets the road. It's typically driven by the people to sustain our infrastructure, increase utility costs because we're bringing more facilities online, and three additional positions to support that veteran bill of rights. We look at our perspective, our portfolio includes over 65 million square feet of office space. Subject to your questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, General Michelina. Do we have any questions for the Department of Military Affairs and Veterans Services? Director Bell?
Thank you, General. First, I want to say this is the first time that the department is before this committee. This will be only the second budget process where you are a combined department. It was a long time coming, and your work and your team's work and the governor's vision that we really centralize services. I also, I think, as you know, and Commissioner Arnold particularly knows, I do enjoy government organization, so I appreciated your team's work in actually putting together an agency that made sense and was well structured. Have we been able to increase and deepen our partnerships with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs? And I know that SAFE has done significant work with them in terms of PPE, but we go above and beyond, I think, in the services we provide. But what additional resources could we look to the feds or hope for from the feds to kind of help support the work that your department's doing?
We have a good working relationship with the Manchester VA, the White River Junction VA, and how we do that is we have what's called a joint, we have a military leadership team. So if you're from outside business, with those leaders from those entities, bringing it all together to create this synergy. The synergy is there, and then what we try to do is figure out, where are the resource opportunities? Is it a grant or this? It allows us to get sort of the synergy and unity of effort to chase the resources that we think are appropriate to serve our veterans. Two examples would be, but it's something that's done internally through, our mission of veteran services, is we just established a veteran-friendly business recognition program. We did that with the Department of Homeland Security, George Lopatis. And we got together and said, okay, hey, how do we acknowledge and recognize our corporate businesses or university system that supports veterans? We're rolling out of a award recognition program, I believe, on December 9th, to acknowledge like 19 different organizations. That's an example. Through the government's submission of alcohol and other drugs, we we follow what's going on in sort of the National Guard, you know, whatever the 53 states and territories are doing. And two examples would be an Operation Purple Star. So we use the Joint Military Task Force to pursue a program to acknowledge our military youth in our schools. Another one we just did too was the Ask a Question campaign. Ask a Question campaign, we call it 2.0, is a function of at 100,000 veterans in the state of New Hampshire, only 30,000 received care for either White River Junction or Manchester VA. 70,000 veterans go to their primary care providers. By doing this Ask a Question campaign, you can reach out to all those primary care providers and say, okay, look, you know, you show up and say, okay, have you ever served in the military? And if yes, it lists a different set of questions in order to try to get after those other issues. I don't think I directly answered your question, but those are examples of the synergy that we're pursuing.
It's all good to know. I'm glad to hear it. I guess my question, more specific, and I could phrase it better, was on the federal side of the House, similar to what we've heard from other agencies, are there any bills before Congress, or are there any initiatives that the state can support to provide federal resources to help support our veterans populations, but through a state agency as opposed to directly through the VA?
On the top of my head, the first thing I can think of is Congressman Pappas has what's called Guard Equity Burial, Guard Reserve Guard Burial Equity Act. For National Guardsmen who've never been activated or mobilized, to allow them to be buried in the state veteran cemetery. So, for example, if you're an 18-year-old kid, graduate from high school, and you join the Air Army National Guard, you serve 6 years honorably, but you've never deployed, you're not authorized to get buried in the state veteran cemetery. So when there's a disconnect like this, you know, we use that relationship with his position on the Health Veteran Affairs Committee to either help him with legislation or try to figure out through him, you know, what's going on. You know, for example, the PFOS, PFOS, at Keys. You know, we're providing the data. We have a registry to collect all the number of service members who served at Keys to create a registry to essentially think, okay, you know, Agent Armour should be enough. Is this another thing or another contaminant that's affecting our veterans that we can track and then get additional benefits through our Division of Veteran Services to get our veterans?
It does. I guess I just know at the national level there's been a focus on the VA and how it provides services to our veterans. And there's a long overdue need to focus on kind of some of the more wraparound services. And I guess I'm wondering if you could expect to see kind of grants to state governments to help provide those wraparound services as opposed to the services provided through the federal wraparound.
I will have to get back to you to make sure I answer your questions correctly. My gut says no. And the reason why I say no is, you know, the separation of church and state, we typically tell everyone we do all things veterans other than healthcare. We're not the veterans VA or the veterans home. And so we usually say if it's a medical or a healthcare provided service, it's not us. We're the service and the benefits in the cemetery.
Commissioner Owens.
I just want to say, you mentioned the cemetery. My father-in-law is there, and it's a beautiful place. And you can do an amazing job. And it's remarkable that, you know, little New Hampshire has this beautiful, beautiful cemetery. I want to say that. And you're doing a heck of a job keeping warm and loving.
Julie, your job.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Oh, and your mask is my favorite mask, which I'm only not wearing today because I had to wash it, but I breathe a lot easier in it than I do in this one. So, nice job.
Thank you, Commissioner. One question I have is search and rescue activity in the White Mountains. Have you guys, I know there's been an increase in people recreating in the outdoors, like we haven't seen in a long time. How has it impacted your search and rescue operations up there?
Not that bad. So in a given year, we probably do between 5 to 8 search and rescue operations. What's beneficial to us is the fact that it enhances our training opportunities. Because, for example, our medevac units just got back from deployment to Iraq, Syria, and Jordan. So those sets and reps, you know, training here, it's actually good. It's back to the person, but it's good for our mission center and our ability to train. And it really hasn't impacted our operations at all.
Thank you. Do we have any questions on the phone? We do not have any questions on the phone. Do we even have any on the phone? We have three people on the phone. Okay, so it hasn't been for not today. Any other questions for Department of Military Affairs and Veteran Services? Director Zell?
I think we'd all be remiss without the move to thank you. Your department has been on the front lines from the beginning of COVID, quite literally on the front lines. I was helping the Department of Health and Human Services and Homeland Security Management and everything from logistics, distribution supplies. So I don't know this definitively, and I guess there's a question here. Is this the largest and longest activation within the state we've seen?
Longest activation ever. If you go back, it's probably the second largest. And ironically enough, in 1977, 78, and 80, the Seabrook nuclear protest played both a powerful role. We had activated over 1,200 soldiers for about a 2-week period each. But in May, we had over 700 activated, and it's a testament to them at all over here.
It is truly a testament. That's an interesting piece of history. I did not know that, but the state owes the men and women gratitude, so thank you for that.
I'd like to echo those comments and also thank you for the history on those two metrics. Unfortunately, I don't think we're quite out of the woods just yet based on recent case flows. I know your department will continue to be called upon. The governor recently issued another request to the federal government. Anything more that we can do, please just let us know. But if you would like to speak to that additional request for the president earlier this week.
Yes, let me give you all context. So the big thing right now is what we call Title 32. And it essentially means who puts the bill for soldiers to be activated or not. So when we say Title 32, 502, F2, it's just a part of the U.S. code that allows typically 100% federal reimbursement. Unfortunately, this last, probably the last 6 weeks or 2 months, you know, the White House cut it to a 75-25% cost share. Where we're trying to go in the future, those orders end on December 31st. We are mandated to make sure our soldiers and airmen self-quarantine for 2 weeks prior to that. So, you know, what we've told the governor's office is, for better or for worse, is a perfect financial storm when I hit the state. With COVID peaking prior to the vaccination, we have to demobilize 200 soldiers and airmen, most likely on or about December 17th and 18th, based upon the funding cost share. The governor's letter to the White House requesting an extension to March 31st had like three big blocks in it. Rock number one was, we're going to want to go from 400 to 900 soldiers who can be activated. And the reason why, that's the worst case planning yet, what our requirements are for vaccination support. The second big rock was changing the 75-25 cost share to 100% federal. And the third big rock was include vaccination support in what's called a FEMA-approved mission assignment. So, for example, about a month ago with employment security, when we had to ask soldiers to go back to the call center to help with unemployment, there, unfortunately, we're putting the state active duty status because it wasn't approved by FEMA as an approved mission assignment. So right now, those are the three big rocks. Up in an army of people to be activated, make sure it's 100% of our cost share, and including any vaccination support for the transportation distribution, you know, giving the vaccination to whoever, make sure that's covered. And that's what we're fighting for now. And the next step we're going to is we took a letter the governor provided. We're providing that to a congressional delegation so they can write a similar letter to the acting secretary.
Thank you, General, for additional context. We appreciate that. Anything further? Seeing none, again, I'd like to thank you for your commitment to the state of New Hampshire, the hard work that's been going on throughout the COVID pandemic, and will continue. And thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Having concluded our final presentation for the day, I would call up this hearing to adjourn. We will resume tomorrow morning at 8:30 with the Secretary of State.
Monday.
Monday, unless you care to be here
tomorrow.
I'll see you Monday.